Radio. Coming up is the news.
The death toll from the Israeli aggression on Gaza has topped 27,100, an average of 230 Palestinians killed every day for the past 4 months. The Yemeni army says it has carried out a new operation against military targets in the Israeli port city of Eilat. And the United States military says it has conducted airstrikes on 85 targets inside Iraq and Syria. Thank you for joining us. Now, intense Israeli attacks on Gaza have been continuing for nearly 4 months now. In the latest spate of attacks, at least 100 people were killed across the besieged Palestinian territory. There were fresh air and artillery attacks around Khan Yunis, that's Gaza's main southern city, which has recently been the focal point of Israeli strikes. Medical facilities in Khan Yunis have been affected as well. Al-Amal and Al-Nasser hospitals have been under an Israeli siege for more than a week. Now, the United Nations is warning of a serious shortage of oxygen supplies at the two medical centres. After Khan Yunis, the city of Rafah will be the next target of the Israeli ground attacks. That's according to the regime's military. Rafah is located in southern Gaza and hosts hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians. UN agencies have been warning about the deteriorating situation in Rafah.
So I want to emphasize our deep concern about the escalation of hostilities in Khan Yunis, which has resulted in an increase in the number of internally displaced people seeking refuge in Rafah. In recent days, thousands of Palestinians have continued to flee to the south, which is already hosting over half the Gaza's population of some 2.3 million people. Most are living in makeshift structures, tents, or out in the open. Rafah is a pressure cooker of despair, and we fear for what comes next.
The spokesman for the UN Humanitarian Office also warned about disease outbreaks in Gaza. He added that there is simply not enough food, not enough clean drinking water, and no protection. The World Health Organization says people in Gaza are enduring unimaginable circumstances. They are exhausted, hungry, and traumatized. And UNICEF says at least 17,000 children in the Gaza Strip are unaccompanied or separated from their family. It says Palestinian children's mental health is severely impacted and almost all of them are in need of support. Over 27,100 people have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. Some 12,500 of them are children. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabe earlier joined us from Deir al-Balah city with more details on the Israeli attacks on Gaza. Let's take a listen.
Israeli bombardments are still continued in the surrounding areas of the society's headquarters in Khan Yunis city, which is Al-Amal Hospital. In addition to that, they noticed that the rainwater actually leaked inside the buildings after the cracks resulted in from the continuous Israeli bombardments. The most important thing is that the dialysis patients in the hospital actually face the risk of death over the continuous siege imposed on the hospital, as the Israeli occupation forces till this moment actually prevent the Palestinian ambulances from evacuating the patients, and they shoot at everything moving in those areas, in the surrounding areas of Gaza Strip. And even though the continuous appeals for the humanitarian and the human rights organizations undergo the Israeli occupation forces still insist on preventing the Palestinian ambulances and the medical staff from moving and to do their job. The current situation is still catastrophic in Khan Yunis city. Meanwhile, the Israeli occupation forces intensify their attacks in the southern part of the city, where Gizan Rashwan, which is a neighborhood in the southern part of the city, has been under heavy bombardment.
Maureen Kasuko is a writer and an activist in Nairobi, Kenya. She earlier joined us to share her views on the genocide in Gaza. She also speaks about measures being taken in Kenya in support of the Gazans.
It's been a very terrible 4 months since October 7th. We are witnessing a genocide take place right now, and atrocities against the people of Palestine by Israel Defense Forces has been very disheartening to witness. You know, just the news is coming in that hospitals are being attacked, that Palestinian people lack medical equipment. The situation is very dire, and for you know, all these Western powers to pull out resources from UNRWA right now when the people need it the most should be considered a war crime. So this is very disheartening to see. And, you know, it's a challenge, it's a call for all of us in the Global South right now to unite and to bring our resources together and to bring our voices together to strongly condemn what is happening in occupied Palestine right now. I'd say a lot of effort is being put together by grassroots community organizers. For example, Kenyans for Palestine. Kenyans for Palestine is a collective of grassroots activists working towards Palestinian liberation efforts. So we have our local BDS movement here in Nairobi. We've been trying to conduct like protests and marches in support of occupied Palestine. Of course, we've been met by state resistance. We've been denied permits here in Nairobi. But I will say that generally, the public has been very responsive to the plight of Palestinians. We've seen so many people show up to our meetings, our Kenyans for Palestine planning meetings.
Palestinian resistance movements are continuing to push back against Israeli forces in Gaza as fighting on the ground intensifies. The military wing of Hamas says it killed at least 15 Israeli soldiers west of Gaza City. The Ghassan Brigade also said its fighters targeted three Israeli Merkava tanks with Ayasin 105 missiles. The group's fighters also hit an armored Israeli personnel carrier in Khan Yunis, south of the Strip. This, as the military wing of Islamic Jihad says, it targeted intruding Israeli forces who had gathered inside the building in Khan Yunis. The Al-Quds Brigade say 10 soldiers there have either been killed or injured. Israel has confirmed the deaths of over 220 of its soldiers since the start of the ground invasion of Gaza. However, Palestinian resistance groups say the actual number of fatalities amongst Israeli forces is much higher, and the regime is covering up its losses, fearing more Israeli public anger. The Yemeni army says it has carried out yet another operation against military targets in the Israeli port city of Eilat. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says Yemeni missile forces or Yemeni forces struck Eilat with a number of missiles. The army says the operations are in solidarity with Palestinians. Yemen has vowed to continue its military operations unless Israel stops its war on the Gaza Strip and ends the siege of the Palestinian territory. Yemeni forces have targeted over two dozen Israeli-run or Israeli-bound vessels in the Red Sea over the past weeks.
Amid the Western aggression against Yemen, thousands of people gathered in the capital Sana'a and other cities to urge the Yemeni army to expand its naval operations against American, British and Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. They also pledged to continue supporting Palestinians at all costs.
Our message to the forces of American Zionist aggression is that you need to stop killing women, children, and defenseless people in Gaza. God has blessed us with Islam, and we will not abandon our brothers in Palestine. The Westerners will see what we will do under the leadership of Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who does what he says.
Our hearts are broken over what's happening in Gaza, including crimes, starvation, and the siege imposed on the people of Gaza. They want those who survived the bombing to starve to death.
Protesters also slammed the European Union's bid to send military forces to the Red Sea, aiming to protect Israeli maritime navigation. The demonstrators said this move will escalate the conflict, since the Yemeni army will have the right to add European vessels to its list of targets.
The European Union is America's plaything. They are indeed many countries, but they follow America's orders to serve American interests. We call the Prosperity Alliance the Suicide Alliance because they commit suicide when they fight us. And we will not change our position no matter how much they threaten us and no matter how large a force they mobilize to fight us.
Any European force that comes to the Red Sea will have the same fate as the American and British forces, meaning that they will become legitimate targets for the Yemeni naval operations and will be hit daily by the Yemeni missile strikes.
Earlier, the leader of the Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, stated that U.S. attempts to seek help from China mediation to stop Yemen's naval operations show the failure of the U.S. and U.K. in their aggression. He also criticized Arab countries for exporting goods to Israel, calling it an act of betrayal as Palestinians starve to death in the besieged Gaza.
Despite the U.S. and U.K. airstrikes, people here insist that Yemeni naval operations should continue as long as the genocidal war on Gaza rages on. They urge their army to target the interests of any party that supports the Israeli regime.
The U.S. says it has carried out airstrikes on 85 targets inside Iraq and Syria. That's after Washington pledged to respond to a deadly drone strike on its troops in Jordan. The U.S. Central Command claims the targets include depots of rockets, missiles, and unmanned drones. The U.S. President says the strikes will continue at times and places of Washington's choosing. However, Joe Biden says the U.S. does not see conflict in West Asia. Washington has confirmed the deaths of three of its forces in a drone strike that hit its military base last weekend. An Iraqi resistance group has claimed responsibility for the attack. It marked the first time U.S. military personnel died in an attack since the start of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza on October the 7th. Belgium has summoned the Israeli ambassador after the country's development agency building was struck in the regime's attacks in northern Gaza. During the meeting with the Israeli envoy, Belgian foreign ministry officials condemned the bombing and the destruction of the offices of the agency known as Enable. According to reports, the strike on the agency took place on Wednesday. Images shared by the Belgian foreign minister shows the building reduced to rubble. However, there were no employees there when the bombing occurred. In its reaction to the attack, Brussels also slammed as unacceptable Israel's bombardment of civilian infrastructure in Gaza. Belgium is a country that has decided to continue to provide financial assistance to the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, despite several countries suspending their aid over some Israeli allegations. Brussels said the UN agency cannot be replaced in supplying urgent humanitarian aid to Gaza. Another sign of growing discontent in the West over support for Israel. More than 800 officials in the US, the UK and the EU have released a public letter of dissent criticizing the government's support for the regime in its ongoing genocide in Gaza. The signatories say Israel has shown no boundaries in its military offensive in Gaza, which has resulted in tens of thousands of preventable civilian deaths and the deliberate blocking of aid. They warned that their government's policies could be contributing to grave violations of international law, war crimes, and even ethnic cleansing or genocide. The signers also say they have already raised concerns through internal channels but were ignored. The document does not include the names of the signers because they fear reprisal. The South African youth has used his iconic neighborhood as the perfect canvas to highlight the plight of the Palestinian people. By adorning the walls of their homes with murals, the community located in the slopes overlooking Cape Town hoped the message of Palestine's fight for liberation will be seen. Hassan Servia took a closer look.
Born of political exiles brought to the Cape of Good Hope by Dutch colonialists, the old Malay quarter of Cape Town, better known as Boerkop, is reaching back to its roots as a location of protest by raising a flag for Palestine. The houses of Boerkop have always been painted in eye-catching colours, but the walls of these homes have now taken on a whole new meaning. Tourists regularly frequent this area, and the paintings here convey a message that will travel around the world. As Palestinians continue to endure the deadly Israeli onslaught on Gaza, a young South African nurse has taken the initiative by painting what some say is the largest mural of its kind for Palestine. He says by painting this large Palestinian flag in a location overlooking the Cape Town Central Business District, Palestine cannot be ignored.
With tourism comes photography, and I decided to allow the world to protest inadvertently from every angle, from every ad, from every Instagram post. Anybody who comes to Boerkop will be for Palestine.
Since launching the Murals for Gaza campaign, Khirdin says scores of residents have asked that their walls be painted to demonstrate support for Palestine. The project has also been taken up in other communities.
If the mainstream media will not report on the atrocities being committed in Gaza, then the walls will speak. That is what we're working with. So we are just making that every wall is going to tell a story from every angle, from the birth of Zionism to the atrocities being committed to the strength and unity of this particular neighborhood on where we stand in the genocide.
Boerkop, on the periphery of the Cape Town CBD, has had to contend with its own struggle of gentrification, as big business and foreigners have tried to evict the traditional residents from their ancestral homes. So they understand well the enduring struggle of Palestinians against the colonial settlers. Hassan Siriap, Cape Town.
And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Islamic revolution and materialization of religious popular rule. The main slogans of the Iranian people during their struggles for the victory of the Islamic Revolution was freedom. For sure, freedom is a very broad concept and has many dimensions. One important aspect of freedom can materialize in determining of the fate of the country and the form of the establishment ruling the country. The Iranian people had sufficiently suffered from the despotism, suffocation, and repression during the British installed and American-supported Pahlavi regime. Thus, they sought a type of system which would guarantee and respect their various rights on the one hand and was independent from foreign intervention and foreign influence on the other. In this, the second program of this special series on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we're going to delve into this subject. Stay with us. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to humbly call himself the servant of the people, although he was the leader of the greatest revolution of the last century and the most effective event of the past centuries. He would emphasize on the unique role of the people in their fate and insisted on the importance of their will, on their rights and fate. The Imam's successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says in this connection, "It was Imam Khomeini who gave the banner of the struggle to the Iranian people. This was quite true, as people's widespread presence in the scene of struggle against the dictatorial regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi successfully overthrew his regime and made the country free from clutches of foreign powers, particularly the United States of America. Leaders of revolutions in various parts of the world put aside people gradually and forget their promises to the people as they seek to follow their vested interests, which are often to the detriment of the people. But Imam Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini was an exception. He strongly believed in the role of the people in the victory and the continuation of the Islamic Revolution. Therefore, immediately after the triumph of the revolution in February of 1979, the Imam ordered the holding of a referendum to determine the type of the ruling system which the people want. Then, over 98% of the participants in the referendum, almost the entire nation, voted for the establishment of the Islamic Republic, which had already been chanted explicitly in their slogans. A few months later, they took part in another referendum to approve Iran's constitution. Part of the prelude of the constitution reads, "The constitution guarantees to annul any kind of ideological and social despotism and economic monopoly, and it tries to break up the despotic system and give the fate of the people over to themselves." Various principles of the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran emphasize on the rights and freedoms of the people in expressing their views, holding of gatherings, publication of magazines and newspapers, etc. Now the Iranian people, benefiting from this achievement of the Islamic Revolution, criticize and protest the performance of officials in various domains. Moreover, the Iranian people enjoy broad freedoms of expression of different opinions on the internet and cyberspace. This was highly manifested during the sedition of the autumn of 2022, when the Western-hired rioters trespassed many red lines of the Islamic Republic at the behest of their masters in Washington, Tel Aviv and London. Yet, very few of them have been arrested or put on trial in a court of law for publication of lies and dashing the hopes of the people and suggesting the inability and disqualification of the ruling system. People's participation in determination of their future through a free and healthy election is an important manifestation of democracy. This has been experienced in Iran almost every year. In other words, nearly 45 elections have taken place in Iran during the past 45 years, since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. According to the principles of the Islamic Republic's constitution and the emphasis of the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei and other influential figures on people's free participation in determining their fate, they have frequently taken part in various elections to determine presidents, parliamentarians, Islamic councils of cities and villages, and members of the Assembly of Experts, which is an institution for supervising and overseeing the leader's performance and appointing the leader if such a requirement arises. The important point about the rule of the people in Iran is that it is Islamic. In an excerpt from the Principle 56 of the Constitution, we read, "Absolute rule on the world and man belongs to God, and it is He who has made man the ruler of his social fate." To make it clearer, in Islam, freedom of will and choice has been granted to man by God, and the Almighty has demarcated its limits according to His infinite knowledge and wisdom. Therefore, man can choose the route of progress and perfection within these limits. Religious popular rule, people's religious rule, is basically different from the flawed and failed democracy chanted and propagated in the West. Popular religious rule has its roots in advanced teachings of Islam, which consider high status for people's vote in determining who their rulers are and the fate of the country. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei expounds on this concept. "We have brought a novel experience. We took democracy from religion. Our democracy is accompanied by spirituality and religion. Thus, it became religious popular rule. It became the Islamic Republic of Iran." Well, dear listeners, the Iranian people vote within the structure of the Islamic values and laws and expect officials to observe all Islamic codes and laws. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone. Let us ponder on this short and sweet saying from Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib. Peace be upon him. "Say good wording and it will be your distinctive feature. Do good deeds and you will be reckoned with its people."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, avoiding false accusations. False accusations is worse than backbiting. It is to falsely attribute a deficiency or an offense to a believing person. It is certain that this transgression is the most wicked of attacks upon the prestige of a believer. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran says, "And whoever commits a fault or a sin, then accuses of it one innocent, he indeed takes upon himself the burden of a calumny and a manifest sin." Before leveling an accusation against anyone, especially a believer, the other believer is always extra cautious. A believer never displays a careless behavior and attitude when it comes to accusing another believer. We have traditions from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam to have positive outlook towards the believers, even if you highly doubt that they have committed a sin. You are supposed to make an excuse for a believer so you can give them a benefit of the doubt. Yet, unfortunately, some habitually, falsely accuse other believers of doing things that they have not done. Isn't that right? This false accusations, you know, sometimes it becomes a habit, right? God forbid, where a person it becomes difficult for him to decipher between a true story and a false story, and he just keeps narrating things carelessly. This is not how a believer is. A believer is extra cautious of every single word that comes out of his mouth. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of avoiding false accusations. And we said that false accusations are worse than backbiting, right? Because as we explained earlier, backbiting is generally, it is truth, right? It is a real deficiency that a mu'min may be carrying. But when it comes to false accusations, this is something ungrounded, something that does not have the reality aspect of it. Now, we're, you know, discussing this topic of avoiding false accusations against believers. Have you ever imagined that there are even those who speak evil of Allah and the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam? Isn't that strange? Let's turn towards the Holy Quran, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Surely, as for those who speak evil of Allah and His Apostle, Allah has cursed them in this world and the hereafter, and He has prepared for them a chastisement bringing disgrace." Brothers and sisters, false accusations against Allah and Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam is a key to disgrace. A person indulged in it gets disgraced in both the worlds. Such a person is cursed in this world and in the hereafter. This means that the blessings of Allah turn away from such a person in this world and the hereafter. One may say that such people usually enjoy many blessings of Allah, right? But this is correct regarding some material blessings of this world. But such a person will never get the more important blessings of Allah, such as the blessing of Iman and faith. So it's not that these people have anything beyond the material blessings. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Yemen.
Part 4.
On December 3, 2017, the Yemeni media announced that a cruise missile with a range of 1,600 kilometers had been fired towards the Baraka nuclear power plant in Abu Dhabi's western desert. Later, video of the missile strike was released, so all the media in regional countries were amazed. It sent a chill down the spine of the Emirati Sheikhdom. Although the Baraka wasn't operational at the time and fuel rods were not injected into the nuclear plant, Ansarallah decided to show restraint and set the missile course in a way so it hit an open area several hundred kilometers away. However, it served as a reminder to the UAE leaders of the constant threat by the Yemeni army's long-range missiles against the facilities inside the UAE. After several months, when the conflicts in Al-Hudaydah heated up on July 26, 2018, Yemeni media sources reported a long-range Asamah drone targeted the Abu Dhabi airport. Abu Dhabi initially decided to put up a media gag on the incident, but after a while, the airport confirmed on X social media platform, formerly known as Twitter, that there was an incident involving a supply vehicle at the airport on July 26 at 4 p.m. and claimed the incident had not affected the airport's operation. However, UAE officials categorically dismissed any drone attack on the airport. Less than a year, in May 2019, the truth came to light. The Al Masira television network somehow accessed and released the video recorded by security cameras at the airport while the Yemeni drone launched a suicide attack and exploded inside the airport. It was almost from that time onwards that the UAE army ruled out the option of getting directly engaged in military confrontation with popular Yemeni forces. Yemen has 15 islands in the Red Sea, Bab el-Mandab Strait, and the Arab Sea that are categorized as five archipelagos of Socotra, Hanish, Zubair, Kamaran, and Perim. Some of the islands have no inhabitants, and some others like Socotra and Kamaran have inhabitants. In March 2015, the Saudi-led coalition kicked off its war on Yemen. The heavy conflict inside Yemen sent tensions over ownership claims on the islands out of focus. But the Emirati leaders were after precise planning to occupy the islands and gain control over Bab el-Mandab and Socotra near the Indian Ocean. The presence of the UAE military in southern Yemen and northeastern coast of Africa and the occupation of the Yemeni islands in that region could give a strategic edge by controlling the maritime transportation through the Bab el-Mandab Strait. The defeat in the Al-Hudaydah port led to a ceasefire deal between the UAE and Sana'a-based government. Gradually, UAE decided to withdraw its forces but had an eye on another strategic region, the Socotra Island.
UAE, very active on Socotra, and also Oman, which has more deep historical ties in the east of the country, now supporting would-be Sultan of Al Mahra and Socotra. So we've got three international players there.
The Socotra Island has unique tourist attractions and flaunts its natural phenomena. Before 2008, when UNESCO put the flora and fauna of the island on its list, it wasn't known to many people. The dream of the UAE leaders to gain control over Socotra dates back to a decade before the war on Yemen. Due to the unique geographical location of the island, the storms from the ocean hit the island and every time inflict huge damage on the infrastructure and the almost 60,000 inhabitants of the island. The UAE's presence on the island dates back to 2000 when a strong storm hit the island. The UAE's Red Crescent sent a few planes carrying humanitarian aid to the island. Abu Dhabi has been seeking to gain a foothold on the island ever since. 8 months after the Yemen war was launched, in November of 2015, Cyclone Meg struck Socotra. The cyclone was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for the UAE Army so they could deploy their military forces and station them on the ground under the pretext of sending aid to the island. As of October 2016, 31 cargo airplanes and a few logistic ships containing food and medical supplies were sent to the people living on the island. At the same time, they increased the number of Emirati forces on the island as well. On April 30th, 2018, the UAE's military planes and warships occupied Socotra and took control of the airport and the pier on the port of the island. About 100 UAE military forces were stationed in sensitive locations on the island and grabbed complete control over the island. Saudi Arabia and the former government of Mansour Hadi protested the move by their former Arab allies. It triggered heavy conflicts between the two sides in southern Yemen. It left thousands of forces from both sides dead or wounded in different areas, including Aden and Shawbah. Two weeks after the occupation of Socotra by the UAE, after Riyadh and supporters of Mansour Hadi ramped up pressure, the UAE army agreed to hand over the administrative control of the island to the resigned government of Mansour Hadi, but it still had military control over the island and airport.
The Emiratis see this as an opportunity to demonstrate some real kind of Arab-style nation building. Economic, rebuild them. And they see the ports as the fundamental way to do this. So now the Emiratis control the port of Mukalla that we talked about earlier. They took back from AQAP. The port of Aden, port of Mocha. If Hodeida gets resolved, then they control the port of Hodeida on the Red Sea. So all the major ports are now basically under Emirati control. Think of Dubai Ports World.
In the summer in 2019, the UAE started to pull its forces out of southern Yemen, a process that took until February of 2020 when they announced that the last batch of official forces was withdrawn from the port of Aden. The occupation of the Socotra Island and the withdrawal of the Emirati forces from Yemen were heavy blows that Abu Dhabi dealt against Riyadh amid the Yemen war. It aroused the wrath of Saudi leaders. After the skirmishes on the southern front ceased and UAE forces withdrew from Yemen, the Saudi army and forces under its command in northern Yemen were being crushed under the heavy strikes by the Yemeni army and popular forces, so they retreated from large oil-rich areas in Al-Jaf and Ma'arib. Saudi Arabia and Mansour Hadi's former government blamed Emirati stab in their back for the retreat, but the UAE leaders knew very well that Saudi Arabia could no longer be their reliable ally in their greater plot in the Bab al-Mandab region. So they were looking for a new partner or a regional power to complete their plan, and for this reason, they ganged up with the Israeli regime.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The number of British households in fuel poverty will continue to worsen, touching 6.5 million from February because of a planned energy price increase and the scaling back of government support. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this and tells us more. According to a study, millions of households will still be living in fuel poverty by the end of the decade and could be forced to pay almost £500 a year extra on their bills because of the government's slow progress on meeting its home energy efficiency targets. A fuel poverty charity has found that 3 million households in England are expected to remain in fuel poverty by 2030. Because the government is expected to miss a legally binding target on upgrading the energy efficiency of homes by a staggering margin. According to National Energy Action, the findings mean that the poorest households in England could be left paying on average £480 more a year on their gas and electricity bills because they are trapped in cold, damp and unhealthy homes. The report undertaken by the National Energy Action, by consultants at GemServe, urged the British government to address a funding gap of at least £18 billion needed to undertake enough measures to ensure that fuel-poor homes in England are brought up to a reasonable standard of energy efficiency by the end of this decade. Adam Scorer, the chief executive of National Energy Action, said, "Based on current situation, we estimate 3 million households in England alone will still be trapped in fuel poverty by 2030, the same number who are currently in fuel poverty in England. 3 million households left cold, damp and unhealthy. Governments risk missing their legal targets, but those living in fuel poverty are at risk of so much more." Angus Brendan McNeill, the chair of the Energy Security and Net Zero Committee, said the report should be a wake-up call for the British government to redouble its efforts on upgrading home energy efficiency. Angus Brendan McNeill said, "As a committee, we have heard countless times about the energy crisis continuing to have a devastating effect on the most vulnerable in our society. Millions of the poorest households across the United Kingdom continue to be exposed to the worst of the crisis due to a lower level of energy efficiency in their homes. The study found that the strategies that each UK nation had put together to address fuel poverty through better home insulation and other efficiency upgrades had been overwhelmed by the scale of the energy cost crisis. In England, the government's target is for all fuel-poor households to reach an EPC rating of C by 2030, but the report found a widening gap in funding required to meet this legal requirement. Fuel poverty is defined by National Energy Action as when a household needs to spend at least 10% of its income on maintaining a satisfactory heating regime. National Energy Action estimates that of the £18 billion needed to reach England's fuel poverty target, £10.8 billion will be publicly funded alongside an additional £7 to £8 billion of private funding from landlords. If equivalent targets were placed across the United Kingdom, additional government funding of £1 billion would be required in Wales, £1.6 billion would be needed in Scotland, and £400 million would be needed in Northern Ireland. Caroline Flint, the chairwoman of the Committee on Fuel Poverty, which advises the government, said, "While we cannot control global energy prices, we can and we must insulate vulnerable people from current and future energy shocks by investing in a housing stock." Caroline Flint added, "Strategies for fuel poverty must be kept upgraded and need to be far more ambitious. If we do, we can all do so much more to help those who cannot currently afford to keep warm every winter and whose health and well-being is currently in serious risk." A spokesperson for the British government said, "Almost half of all homes in England have an energy efficiency rating of C or above, up from 14% in 2010, and we estimate that more than 300,000 of Britain's least energy-efficient homes will be improved by 2026, helping to heat homes and save families money on their energy bills." The spokesperson for the government added, "We've changed the law so rogue social landlords can no longer hide from their responsibilities and must act quickly when issues are raised, including damp and mould, as we work to introduce strict time limits to fix homes through AWAB's law." Bloomberg News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. The number of British households in fuel poverty will continue to worsen, touching 6.5 million from February because of a planned energy price increase and the scaling back of government support. National Energy Action said in a statement published recently, "Many Britons struggling with their high energy bills on top of a cost of living crisis, already using shocking coping tactics, with 2 million people self-disconnecting and going without any power and natural gas use." While wholesale prices have eased from the peak of Europe's energy crisis last year, British consumers are still grappling with elevated energy bills because most government support in Britain has now ended. Meanwhile, regulator Ofgem raised the national price cap for energy to £1,928 from January, up 5% from current levels. That's an annual bill for a typical British household, but those using the least amount of energy are facing a bigger rate increase. Right now, according to the National Energy Action, 6.3 million British households are in fuel poverty. National Energy Action said that that's up from 4.5 million recorded in October of 2021, when Europe's energy crunch began. The study showed over the last 3 months, millions of people have been using appliances like ovens or going to bed early to stay warm. According to data from the Statistics Office, Based on the charity's estimates, more than 20% of Britain's households would be energy poor from February. Several suppliers, including the country's biggest energy provider, Centrica PLC, have already urged the government to consider measures to support vulnerable consumers this winter. Centrica's chief executive officer, Chris O'Shea, said in a separate statement, "Customers are struggling with their high energy bills. In the meantime, the number of British households living in temperatures below 18 degrees Celsius for periods last winter climbed by almost 240,000 compared with the winter before, raising concerns among fuel poverty charities that rocketing energy bills are posing a risk to British people's health.
Midstream.
The Islamic Revolution, after its victory, managed to change the political geography and geopolitical structure of the region. The credit for this change goes to the nature of the discourse of the Islamic Revolution. The ideological framework and the valuable human content presented by leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, may his noble secret be sanctified, as the speaker and founder were able to create a new model and introduce a new composition to the region and the world as a whole. With the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the people of the region realized that they could stand against the West and the East and change the equations. The successive failures of the Zionist entity and the United States of America and the region indicate that the Islamic Revolution was the source of inspiration for the peoples of the world, and especially in West Asia. Certainly, without exaggeration and in a scientific and objective manner, we can say that the period before the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran is not the same as the period after it. At the level of the conflict with the Zionist enemy, 1 year before the revolution, Egypt had signed the Camp David peace agreement with the Zionist enemy, and it was said that time that Egypt's exit from the conflict meant that the conflict with this enemy had ended, and the agreement with Jordan was added to it. Many expected that the resistance against this enemy would end after these agreements, but the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran brought the region into a new equation and into direct conflict with the Zionist enemy. Since the first days of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has clearly stood against the Israeli entity, and as is known, it closed the Israeli entity embassy and turned it into an embassy for the state of Palestine, and stated clearly that this entity is illegitimate, and confirmed that it will stand by the legitimate resistance in Palestine, and this was a new equation. No one could have expected it. This seemed to bring about major changes in the resistance movement and in the development of the resistance movement in Palestine and the region of West Asia. The pressures of the U.S. and Zionist Israeli attacks and divisive projects targeting Islamic communities that we witness today are a direct result of the existence of this resistance. If it weren't a strong axis of resistance, the United States wouldn't need to exert these efforts, carry out attacks, and impose sanctions. Therefore, today's confrontation is clear and challenging, especially since the axis of resistance in West Asia has become an essential part of regional and international equations. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. What truly angers the United States of America regarding the Islamic Republic of Iran is the process of building power and the country's regional sovereignty. This power has crystal